The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm not Joel Grey, your master of ceremonies, but I am Leonard Malton. And with me,
Baron Vaughn. But you know, there was a very famous revival of Cabaret a couple years ago, starring one of the actors that we're going to talk about later.
That is absolutely true.
Yes. So good reference. That's Leonard Malton foreshadowing.
Oh, it's all part of the plan. It's all
sleeper.
Part of the master plan, Baron.
Okay,
that's what we're all about, planning.
Perfect.
Well, hello, folks. Thanks for joining us, as always. And we do have a theme today, and the theme is inspired by a current film.
Yes.
Russell Crowe has a new movie out called The Water Diviner, and it marks his feature film directorial debut.
Oh, goodness.
But he's also in it. He's the star and director of the film. Now, this is a tradition that goes back literally over a century, because even before Charlie Chaplin did it, his boss, Max Sennett, was directing himself in early biograph comedies, and so Chaplin, of course, became one of the more celebrated actor-directors. His early co-star, Mabel Normand, one of the first female actor-directors, and a long, long, long list we could draw from then to now with stops at such celebrated figures as Orson Welles, such more recent figures as Clint Eastwood. There are many, many examples of
some movies we've already spoken about.
Yes, we have.
For instance, The Great Debaters, which was directed by Denzel Washington, which Denzel Washington is also in. And Spike Lee was in Malcolm X.
Yep.
And he's usually in his own movies.
Yes, that's true.
And directs them as well.
But he usually doesn't bear the full weight of a starring
Not
role.
Not the full brunt of being the lead of the movie.
And this I will never fully understand. I will never completely understand how someone does this. And you're an actor. You may be able to address this more fully or more intelligently than I. But acting requires a certain kind of focus.
Yes, it does.
But it also requires you to get sort of lose yourself to a degree in the scene, right?
Yeah, you know. And I was talking about this with a friend last night because we were talking about Ben Affleck. Because Ben Affleck has done this as well with The Town and Argo. And my friend thinks that those are his best performances when he's directing himself. And the theory is this, that basically if you're directing yourself, you kind of have carte blanche. You don't have anyone telling you what to do and how to act the scene. And essentially you get to mold everyone around your own performance. So in a sense, it's the most egomaniacal thing that you can do in a way. But some people can do it really well, and I will watch it. And some people don't do it well at all. The Room. But still, I think that there's a freedom maybe to just being able to – no one's in your face telling you what to do. So you kind of
can
explore.
Well, I get that part. No, yeah. I understand that part. But directing requires you, insists that you be aware – of everything going on that set, everything.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not hyper aware of everything going on, then you're not doing your job.
But I think there's a little bit more trust given to everyone else.
Of course.
If you're directing yourself.
Right, the cinematographer,
yes.
The assistant director, all of these people around you, yes. I understand that too. And yet.
You're still like, how do they do
yeah,
it?
Yeah, how quite do they do that?
Well, until I'm in those shoes, I'll never know.
You'll send us a postcard.
Yes, indeed. From the edge. Postcard from the edge.
So we're going to begin today with a really outstanding film that is exactly 15 years old, and it is called Pollock. And it stars its director and producer, Ed Harris.
Ed Harris, a real actor, a true actor. That's the only thing I can say about him.
Well,
he's a real actor.
Great American actor.
Yeah, he's incredible.
I don't think anybody would debate that. He's got four Oscar nominations to his credit. We usually like to cite those things, and those four are films I think you'll all remember: Apollo 13, The Truman Show, Pollock, which we're discussing, and The Hours. And he directed one other film about 8 years later. He wrote, produced, and directed a Western called Appaloosa, The Appaloosa, which I wanted so much to like because I love Westerns. We haven't talked Westerns yet, but we will.
Oh, we should.
And this one just didn't do it for me. He is the outstanding star of this film, playing the great painter, the great American painter, Jackson Pollock. Now, there have been many screen biographies of artists. This is not unique. It goes back many years, and there have been some notable performances, too. Kirk Douglas in Lust for Life, et cetera, down the line. You can sort of figure it out and name them all. But this one does something very few films manage to do, and it's not just about a painter that this happens. There have been biographies of composers and other artistic and creative people. It's so hard to get inside their head.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so hard to really illustrate and dramatize the creative process, the act of creating, the art of creating and the act of creating. And somehow this film manages to do it to a very great degree.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And he was a complex man, a very complex man, and had some very intense relationships with his actual family, the Pollocks, brothers and mothers and et cetera, and then his wife, his much put upon wife, played beautifully by Marcia Gay Harden, who is one of my favorites.
Well, she's a wonderful actress, and she got an Oscar for this. She won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar.
Damn right she did.
And she certainly earned it. This is a pretty terrific job that she does because she's playing – well, first off, she's playing one with a Brooklynese accent.
And a Brooklyn accent from the 50s, the 40s and the 50s. Yeah.
And she's completely convincing at that and in every other facet of this – this difficult character, a woman who is an artist herself and
basically becomes his agent. She becomes the agent of Jackson Pollock, her husband.
And his booster. And so her name was Lee Krasner. In real life, the character was named Lee Krasner. And she was an artist with talent, not his originality, not his unique worldview. But talent. But she sublimated her talent and sublimated her career because she recognized earlier than most his genius.
It's almost as if Salieri married Mozart. Except it's not trying to destroy him in the meantime. Yeah.
Except for those two things. It's exactly the same. It's notable, I think, to point out that this film was written by two women. Given that the female character is so interesting, the primary female, all the female characters are interesting. We'll get to some of those in a moment. But it was written by Barbara Turner and Susan M. Schwiller. Now, Barbara Turner, whose name we will invoke later on because she is the mother. She's the mother of the great actress Jennifer Jason Leigh. She wrote The Company, the ballet film for Robert Altman. She adapted Petulia many years ago for Richard Lester. She wrote a film for her daughter and Mary Winningham called Georgia back in 1995. More recently, she wrote the cable TV movie Hemingway and Gellhorn with Nicole Kidman and Clive Owen that was directed by Philip Kaufman. So Barbara Turner, who started as an actress and became a screenwriter, has a long list of interesting and solid credits. Her co-screenwriter, and I don't know if they collaborated or if this was two different drafts of a screenplay, is Susan M. Schwiller, another former actress who became an art director and worked quite a lot with Robert Altman. And if the last name sounds familiar, she's the daughter of the famous avant-garde filmmaker Ed M. Schwiller. So interesting people worked on this movie, and they based the screenplay on a book called Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. Now, that doesn't make the movie any more or less accurate than any other biopic, but at least they had source material that is apparently solid.
But definitely that subtitle, An American Saga, that's present in the film.
Yes.
Because Jackson Pollock was an American, and an American at a very particular time, in which you get to see in this film some really interesting view of New York and of the country. at that time and how it worked and how it influenced Jackson Pollock.
One of the first things that impresses me as I'm watching, as I'm revisiting this movie, is the period feel.
Yes.
It's effortless. You know, I don't know if you get the same feeling I do, Baron. Sometimes some movies seem to be showing off their old cars.
Well, we said that when we watched Me and Orson Welles.
Yeah.
That there's a light touch to the period. It's never forced. It's never shoved down our throats. It's just, it's there.
Yeah.
As it would have been for these people. Yeah. Just there. Not like, boy, isn't it crazy? I have a radio over here. Click. Now we're listening to Walter Winchell. No, it's just there.
Pollock pulls this off very well. The exteriors are all great, the New York City exteriors. The interiors, the apartments, the somewhat worn-looking apartment buildings and apartments themselves. And they don't look like sets to me. They look like real apartments. Now, I could be proven wrong. But there's just a tangible feel of being there at that time. And all credit to production designer Mark Friedberg, who just this past year designed Selma, another period piece. He's got a lot of credits, but Selma is his latest.
Selma did not feel forced as well.
No, same thing. And the cinematography by Lisa Rinsler. I mean, all of these collaborators really did their – I worked at a very high level here for Ed Harris, possibly because he gave himself so much to this film. Picture this. Now, you're not supposed to be thinking about this as you watch the movie, and I try not to. But I remember when it came out, reading that he said it took something like 2 years for him to learn to paint like Jackson Pollock because he was determined that he was going to paint on camera convincingly as Jackson Pollock. None of those movie tricks where you see the hands in a separate shot.
And honestly, I was thinking about that as I was watching. I'm like, he's really painting.
Yeah.
He's really painting these paintings, and these paintings look really good.
Yeah.
And like they're Jackson Pollock paintings.
I know. Astonishing. Whew. Just astonishing. So he gets that right. He gets that absolutely down pat. But then he also gets the torment, the inner torment, the self-destructive nature of Pollock.
Self-destructive is an understatement. Holy crap.
It is, really. Because the film starts with a very brief scene at a gallery at the height of his early fame, 1949. And then the film flashes back to 1941 when he's not yet discovered, not yet really fully formed as an artist.
He's frustrated, and boy, does he hate Pablo Picasso.
So he takes out a lot of his frustrations with the bottle. He's an alcoholic, and he's a nasty drunk.
The meanest version of an alcoholic.
Terrible drunk. He's also classified 4F during World War II, which for you youngsters in the audience meant that unable to serve or unfit to serve. That was the Army or Armed Forces qualification, 4F. He never addresses it directly as if it embarrasses him. But there's some early discussions with other friends over a dinner table or a party where it's clear that he's uncomfortable. He's certainly uncomfortable. And whether that fuels helps fuel his alcoholic intake, I don't know. But it wouldn't shock me if that was the case.
Probably there's some man stuff in there as well, feeling like less of a man that he can't serve for his country.
Well, you see him starting out, and he's talented, like his companion and then later wife, Lee Krasner. He's clearly talented, and you know that right away. But then he starts going in his own direction. He's already painting a modern form of art, and there's a wonderful little it's like a cameo by Bud Cort. Yes, the Harold and Maude Bud Cort. That Bud Cort, the Brewster McCloud Bud Cort, older, heavier set, and perfectly cast and costumed as a – it's not clear if he's an art critic or just a gadfly on the New York art scene.
He's sort of a representative for
he's the one
Peggy
who,
Guggenheim.
Right. He's the one who brings Pollock to the attention of the famous art patroness Peggy Guggenheim.
Played by Amy Madigan.
Mrs. Ed Harris,
uh-huh.
with an incredibly severe hairdo,
Severe. I was wondering what you would say. That's a good adjective.
Oh, she's got a great look. Well, Amy Madigan's a wonderful actress, and this is a great part for her, and she nails it. She hits the bullseye with this. Because Peggy Guggenheim is a woman with very strong opinions and a very strong sense of self and a savvy business person, too. She's not doing this for charity. She becomes a patroness at first, but then she's also an art dealer.
One of the first scenes where we see her, she has showed up to Pollock's apartment, and he's not there. So when we see Pollock and Lee, his wife Lee, come to the apartment for the appointment, Peggy Guggenheim and Bud Cort are leaving. He's carrying her two little dogs, and she's like, "I do not walk up five flights of stairs." Yes, she's a very opinionated. It gets out there right away.
Pretty funny. Well, there are a couple of key moments. And these are not spoilers. Couple of key moments. Peggy Guggenheim commissions him to do a mural for her apartment, and it's going to be enormous, like 8 feet long. Or is it 20 feet long? It's 20 feet long.
Yeah.
Eight feet high, something like that.
Just to the entrance of her giant place. She wants a painting there.
We see him build the canvas for this, and then he stands and stares at the blank canvas, and at one point he casts a shadow.
Oh, beautiful.
Lighting
beautiful
is such that he casts a shadow on this blank canvas and with his hands on his hips trying to figure out what he's going to do.
Heavy metaphor.
He's looking. He's pondering. He stares and stares and stares. And then he starts doing it. And it's a pretty extraordinary sequence. Again, you can't get completely inside the man's head. That's not possible. But you begin to understand something of the process. And when he then accidentally – this in an old Hollywood movie would have been done even more broadly. But they would have us believe that his famous drip and spatter technique came about by accident. And I'm willing to believe that. Mm. I don't think they would have done that in this movie made up of whole cloth. I'm going to take their word. But it is the aha moment. It definitely is the aha moment.
And it's done very, very, very well.
And it's done extremely well. And then again, you get to see Ed Harris paint like Jackson Pollock.
Like Jackson Pollock. But you also get to see what it takes out of him.
Yeah.
What Pollock is losing, essentially. He's putting his soul on these canvases, and then he tries to put alcohol inside himself to fill up what he left out.
Well, and there are other complications too. Then he has the complication of fame.
Yes.
Which is another factor, fame and the expectations. Before, there were no expectations. Now he has a reputation, something to live up to. Does he have to top himself, better himself in some way? How's he going to do that? What's it going to take? All of this is part of his makeup. And he moves to Long Island. He and Lee moved to Long Island to a rural spot, which is a good move for them. And where he actually flourishes, but also suffers.
A lot of isolation out there.
What a movie.
Yeah.
What a life movie. And what a movie.
Pollock.
I can't imagine directing this and acting in this.
Yeah.
I read one source. I don't trust all the sources I read online. You know that.
Of course.
It said that he collapsed at one point, had to be hospitalized.
Ed Harris did.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I mean
– just too much.
I believe it. Believe that to be true, seeing what it is that he put of himself in this role. But see it to believe it, everyone.
Good people all through the movie. Tom Bauer, John Hurd, Seda Thompson as his mother, as Pollock's mother, Jeffrey Tambor as an art critic. All really good. All really, really good. Jennifer Connelly and primarily Marcia Gay Harden and the amazing Ed Harris. Wow.
Don't forget Val Kilmer.
Oh, Val Kilmer, right, as William de Kooning, yeah. I'm shaking my head back and forth in awe. You can't see that, folks. This is audio, but I'm shaking my head back and forth in awe. And also because not having seen this in 15 years, it got me all over again. It really did.
It stands. It holds up.
Yeah.
It's just a damn good film.
Wow. Well, let's wind the time machine back for something else, too.
Okay.
All right. Do you remember, now you're younger than I am, but you are a theater guy.
Yes.
Do you remember seeing Henry V? Do you remember
yes.
how you responded to that?
Yes.
I'm talking about Kenneth Branagh's Henry V.
Yes, Kenneth Branagh's Henry V came out in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I didn't see it then exactly, but I remember seeing it probably on HBO or something. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away. I was completely floored by it. I thought, I was like, who's this Kenneth Branagh? How do you say it? How do you say it? But he captured the reality, I guess, of just war. It was a big war movie because Henry V is like a rah-rah, siskumbah, let's go to war sort of a play. And he had all the bombastic nature of it. He had the small moments. I was like, this guy's pretty interesting. What about yourself, Leonard?
Oh, yeah. I saw it, and like an awful lot of other people said, wow, who is this guy?
Redefining Shakespeare on film, this guy.
And, of course, I was not the only one who was thinking to myself, this is the new Olivier. This is our generation's Laurence Olivier. And, of course, Olivier made – pardon my cough – Olivier made a brilliant and famous version of Henry V in the 1940s during World War II. Toward the waning days of World War II. So Branagh just, you know, knocked it out of the park, to use a bad colloquial expression for Shakespeare. But what a film. Well, he became the new It boy, so to
yeah.
speak.
I mean, an It director as well.
And exactly. And Henry V was also, I believe, the first time I saw his then wife, Emma Thompson. She was already building a name for herself in England, but I don't think had made any waves here on this side of the pond. So it was a dual discovery for me and an awful lot of other people. So Hollywood beckoned, as Hollywood does.
Mrs. Kenneth Branagh, hello, it's Hollywood. I've been waiting for your call.
And apparently he had been, just to try something different, do something new. He'd already conquered theater in the UK and then film. And now why not a Hollywood movie? Why not? We'll tell you in just a moment.
Now on Thursdays from the founders of the ultimate industry screenwriting staple, The Blacklist, comes The Blacklist Table Reads, an exciting new podcast that takes the best screenplays Hollywood hasn't made yet and turns them into movies for your ears. Every month, The Blacklist Table Reads will be turning one script into four weekly episodes, complete with writer interviews from Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard, a fusion of classic radio theater with the most talked about scripts in Hollywood. Seriously, a truly unique listening experience. Their first script is the outrageously satirical comedy Balls Out by Malcolm Spellman, currently a producer on Empire, and Tim Talbot, winner of the 2015 Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance, with the cast featuring Paul Scheer, Matt Walsh, Lauren Lapkus, Casey Wilson, and more. Ooh, and more is in that? I love and more. The Blacklist Table Reads, Thursdays on Wolfpop. Welcome back to Maltin Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm Baron Vaughn again.
I'm Leonard Maltin again.
And we're going to talk about a movie called...
Dead. Again? It's called Dead Again.
Yes.
Right.
But that's how you felt when you had to watch it.
Yeah.
It's like,
Dead
Again?
Again? All right, here's the deal. I saw this in 1991.
Yeah, when it came out.
A major studio movie, a Paramount picture, made actually here in Hollywood, starring Kenneth Branagh. Directed by Kenneth Branagh.
And you had high expectations because of that Henry V movie he made.
As did we all. Co-starring his then wife, Emma Thompson, and Andy Garcia, Derek Jacobi, the great Derek Jacobi, a lot of other good people, Campbell Scott, Hannah Shigula, who was then known for all of the Fassbinder films she was in Germany, and unbilled at the beginning, Robin Williams, kind of a surprise to see him in the film in a serious role, Wayne Knight, Christine Ebersole. So strong cast up and down the line. And a screenplay by Scott Frank, a writer I greatly admire.
We'll
talk about him a little more in a moment. So here comes this whodunit, I guess you'd call it.
Mm.
Sort
noir.
Of a romantic noir whodunit set in the present day with extensive flashbacks to 1949. And they decided at some point to put the flashbacks into black and white to keep very clear the differentiation between the two time periods. Okay. What I remember from seeing it then and what I think I wrote about it then, the two words that really stood out for me were artificial.
Okay.
And dense.
Oh.
Okay.
I thought they were going to be what and is this.
Having just reviewed it, the words I would use would be artificial.
Okay.
And uninvolving.
Ooh.
I kept waiting for the movie to really get started or build up a head of steam or do something to pull me in.
To go somewhere.
Yeah. Now, my first problem – now, look, we are all accustomed to seeing Brits and Aussies and even Kiwis play American. It's become so commonplace now. And it's so commonplace that in some cases we don't even realize we've been fooled.
Oh, yeah. I explained the other day to my mother who was British on television, mm-hmm. and she had no idea – no idea. But that said, Kenneth Branagh in this movie, ugh.
Yeah. See, the problem is he's Kenneth Branagh, and it's hard to forget that he's Kenneth Branagh. So when – well, in the opening scenes – this is not a spoiler, folks. In the opening scenes, we see him in flashback playing this German conductor, very distinguished German orchestra conductor. With a goatee, a mustache and a goatee.
Very German looking.
Yes, a very stiff bearing to him. And then we meet him in the present day story where he's a Los Angeles gumshoe. And he talks not New York accent. He's just talking very street vernacular kind of stuff, you know?
It like, feels like it's supposed to be a New York accent,
yeah,
even though this movie does not take place in New York.
It's disconcerting. It's not that it's a bad American accent. It's a fine American accent. It's just he doesn't persuade me. Mm. And that's only because I'm hyper aware of who he is.
Yeah, his name precedes him.
You know, this is why sometimes I think directors make a smart move by casting unknowns in movies. When you cast an unknown, you don't bring any baggage.
No baggage. That's why indie film is so great to me.
Yeah.
At least. There's no baggage. You could just focus in on the story.
You know, I mean, the famous example, I don't know if it's famous or it's just the one I always cite. It's famous because I say it over and over again.
Okay.
It's when Richard Attenborough cast Ben Kingsley as Gandhi. At that time, none of us had ever seen or heard of Ben Kingsley. So there was no barrier toward us accepting him as Gandhi.
Right.
And it was a great performance by a very talented man, so he did the job.
Right.
He convinced us. He persuaded us. But here, we know it's Kenneth Branagh. Even in 1991, we knew it was Kenneth Branagh, and it's just hard. A little easier to accept Emma Thompson's American accent, but that's tough too. She's so quintessentially British.
Right, right.
And again, that's been reinforced over the ensuing years, so that watching it today in 2015, it's even harder to accept her.
But you know, in the 90s, especially 91 when this movie came out, it wasn't as commonplace as it is now.
No, like, it's become epidemic now.
Yeah. Yeah, epidemic. But so it was like, it was very different to have British people playing Americans, and especially to have two people who were in everyone's minds as the most British of all the British people.
Yep.
It's like the Queen was going to be in this movie playing an American. It's just – you can't separate the two.
Yeah.
It worked against the movie in a big way.
I think it does. It's a real hindrance. It's a speed bump. I don't know what you'd call it, but it just gets in the way. It's an obstacle. There's the word. It's an obstacle.
Good word.
Le mot juste, obstacle.
There you go.
And I found it that as a viewer. That script is a bit of an obstacle too. And again, I really admire Scott Frank. He's known for his great adaptations. He's adapted several Elmore Leonard books like Get Shorty and Out of Sight very successfully. He adapted Marley and Me, very sweet movie. Mm. And he has made two really good films as writer-director, The Lookout, a favorite movie of mine from 2007 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and the one we discussed not long ago, A Walk Among the Tombstones with Liam Neeson.
Which is a fantastic film.
Adaptation of a book also. This is a talented man. So we won't hold this against him because we'll just, you know, agree not to do that.
Well, but then Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson are talented as well.
Oh, brilliantly talented.
It's just that everything didn't come together in this movie.
Oh, what is it about?
Yeah,
well, okay, so find out what it's about is one of the challenges of this movie.
There's been a murder.
In brief, yes, in brief, there was a murder. You find this out in the opening shots.
A long time ago.
A notorious headline-making murder case where a noted conductor, a German emigre living in Los Angeles, murdered his beautiful wife with a scissors.
They call him the scissor killer.
And he's committed to death row. Okay? The reporter who covered the story, whose byline we see over and over and over again, is played by Andy Garcia. And then in other flashbacks that follow, we see that Andy Garcia had a chance to meet Emma Thompson's character, to incur the jealousy of her husband, Kenneth Branagh, the conductor. But we don't know how all that, you know, figures in the ultimate murder case and right. its aftermath.
Right.
In the present day, Branagh is a private eye for hire who does a favor for a priest who helped raise him.
Right, like a Catholic orphanage.
Mm-hmm. Because they've taken in a woman who has amnesia and has apparently lost the ability to speak. She's mute.
She has these horrific nightmares.
Yes.
In which her blood-curdling screams fill the halls of the institution she's mm-hmm. in. Not an institution, the orphanage. And so the priest decides they're going to hire the gumshoe
as
to find out.
Who's going to do it as a favor.
Yeah, yeah. To find out who this woman is, like what her story is.
And so he takes her in and tries to find out what's going on. And he is helped by an antique dealer who happens to dabble in hypnosis, played by the always brilliant Derek Jacobi. And he starts to put her into trances to try to get her to regress, I think is the word. And it seems that maybe there is a touch of reincarnation involved here and other things are going on. I won't reveal more than that. The movie barely reveals more than that for the first hour.
It's called Dead Again.
Yeah, and it's dead for a long time before it has some life to it. And then there's another – now, this is not an obstacle. This is a brick wall
okay.
for the viewer. Late in the film, we meet the older reporter played in present day by Andy Garcia in the worst old age makeup I've ever seen.
Worse than J. Edgar?
Arguably worse than J. Edgar.
No, it is
Although
worse.
That would be a close match.
Well, just even for the era. I mean, it was 91, so yeah. It's just – it's cartoonish. You've never seen an elderly person that looks like this.
No. It looks like they were making him up to be Imhotep, the mummy, and didn't finish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they got called away, and they didn't finish the job. Oh, my gosh.
It's unbelievable and cartoonish.
It's so ludicrous that it just takes you out of the – if you're in the movie, it takes you out of the movie.
Right.
And if you're trying to stay in the movie, it takes you out of the movie. Just appalling. Appalling.
And hilarious.
And again, I felt that then. So it's not that I've seen – of course, makeup continually improves. The art of makeup is constantly evolving. And yes, they can do more now than they could in 1991. Granted. But even in 1991, they could have done better than this.
Or you could have found once you saw – once if you were the director of this movie, if you're Kenneth Branagh
yeah.
and then you saw Andy Garcia's makeup, you'd be like, you know what? Let's do this scene in a very different way.
Right.
Maybe we cannot see him on screen yeah. because this looks ridiculous.
Or shoot the whole thing over his shoulder.
Woo.
Put
him
closet.
In shadow. Put him in shadow
Put
when
him
he's
in
lighting
shadow.
A cigarette.
Exactly right. Do anything, but don't linger on that makeup. Whoa.
It's a doozy.
Whoa, oh boy.
Wow. A lot of great people, but like pretty much every turkey we've talked about, sometimes great people don't make good stuff.
Yeah. I would call this a misfire more than an outright turkey.
Okay.
Although, frankly, I gave it a kind of a middling review mm-hmm. back in 91. And I think I would give it a harsher review today, quite honestly, because I had a very hard time getting engaged, getting involved in this film. Now, Branagh's had an interesting and certainly an eclectic career since then.
Oh, yes.
He seems to have fared best when he's returned to Shakespeare territory, as he does every now and then. It's obviously a great passion for him. He won a lot of people over to Shakespeare with Much Ado About Nothing in the early 90s.
Exactly, because Denzel Washington was in it.
He did his version of Hamlet. He did As You Like It. He's, you know, he's gone back to the stage. He's done many, many things. As a film director for hire, he's done Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He's done Sleuth, a remake of Sleuth. He did an opera, The Magic Flute. He did a Shakespearean Thor.
Very Shakespearean.
For Marvel, yes. Too Shakespearean, I might say. He did Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit and just recently had a box office smash when he did Cinderella for the Disney Company. And he's been very successful on television with that Wallander series, the adaptation of the Swedish
Wallander,
which he produces as well. So good for him because he's a great talent and deserves every success he gets. But this was just a misfire. And there's not much more we can say about that.
A bullet was fired and it missed the target.
It missed the target.
But it was fired by somebody that has some skill.
That's right.
And should have had a better aim.
Yep.
But these things happen and now we're dead again. Almost a rhyme.
Thank
Almost
you, Mr. Metaphor. Okay. But we're going to recover.
Yes.
Going to recover with a good one. A good one that, as I said before, was written – well, no, I didn't say it was written by. It was written and directed by two talented actors, and one of them is the daughter of the aforementioned Barbara Turner, co-screenwriter of Pollock. That's too obtuse, isn't it?
Not necessarily.
Well, all right. We're going to fill in
– it's a bit more isosceles, but you know.
All will be revealed, friends, in just a moment. You all know Amazon, and since you hopefully love our show too, here's a way you can love both at the same time. The next time you want to shop at Amazon, don't go there directly. That's for losers. Instead, go to wolfpop.com/Amazon, and the prices will be the same great Amazon prices you know and love. But here's the difference. We'll get a sweet, sweet kickback. So you don't have to pay an extra dime. But Wolfpop gets credit from Amazon, and that adds up, helps us keep the engineers happy and the microphones turned on. So remember, go to wolfpop.com/Amazon and bookmark that puppy too. So every time you need to buy something, be it batteries or a Kindle or a television or a cardigan or a last second present for your loved one's birthday, you use our special link and that'll help us earn cash at the same time. It's a win-win. Thanks. Here we are again, Baron Vaughn.
Leonard Maltin.
And me. And we're going to discuss our sleeper of the week, and our sleeper is a film that we both like a lot called The Anniversary Party from 2001. It was written and directed by its stars, Jennifer Jason Leigh and Alan Cumming, and they wrote it specifically for their actor friends.
Yes.
So virtually every role in this film was tailor-made for the person playing the part.
Now, that's one of the reasons that I originally saw this movie, because everyone I knew had seen it said, oh, you know, this is like them and their friends, like their buddies. And also Phoebe Cates is in it.
Yes.
Because she had retired from and came out of retirement to be in this movie, which is amazing.
With her real-life husband,
Kevin Kline. With her real-life husband and real-life children.
And their two adorable children and precocious children. It's a really interesting film.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a comedy, drama.
Dramedy.
A dramedy, if you will, if you must. About a couple. She's an actress who is retired. He's an author who has just gotten the go-ahead to direct his first movie from his screenplay, an adaptation of that novel. And he's on the verge of doing that. And they had split up for a while. There had been some stress cracks in their marriage, but now they've gotten back together. They've been back together about 5 months.
Yeah, it's never specifically said what it is that happened, but it is acknowledged by everybody multiple times.
And so they decide to have a party, celebrate their anniversary, and they invite a whole bunch of friends and some people who aren't precisely friends. They invite his business manager, who's sort of a friend, but is also a business associate. and his wife, played by John Benjamin Hickey and Parker Posey.
Fantastic.
And they invite their neighbors with whom they've been having a very contentious time because of their constantly barking dog. And the neighbors are played by Dennis O'Hare and Mina Badi. And Mina Badi is Jennifer Jason Leigh's half-sister.
Oh, okay.
They share a mother, and her father was Reza Badi, the prolific television director and theater director. Dennis O'Hare, a wonderful actor.
So yes.
They're the couple that bring tension the moment they arrive to the party.
It gets tense.
Yeah, because he especially doesn't want to be there. He does not want to be part of this because he's just pissed off. He's so upset about that dog.
But his wife is trying to make some sort of peace.
Yes.
Even in the first scene, the moment they walk through the door, they're already talking about the dog until Alan Cumming says, okay, look, let's not talk about that. It's a party. Let's try to be civil here.
Then there's Jane Addams, who's recently given birth and is very uptight about leaving her infant for the first time with a babysitter. So she has a pager. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
And her husband, John C. Reilly. There's Jennifer Beals, who's a photographer and whose photography adorns the walls of this house. And apparently she really shot all those pictures, which is kind of interesting. And she has had a relationship, a close relationship, perhaps a very close relationship with Alan Cumming in the past.
It's a bone of contention with the wife, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Right. And then there's the movie star, the Golden Girl, who is going to star in Cumming's new movie, playing a character that is clearly based on Jennifer Jason Leigh, his wife. So there's a lot of tension and ill will there.
Hollywood awkwardness.
Yes, and she's played by Gwyneth Paltrow and played very well by Gwyneth Paltrow. And there are other people who come and go, but those are the principal players. There's a fellow named Michael Paines who's actually very good, who I don't know very much about or very much to say about him, except that he's good in this film as a kind of a best friend to Jennifer Jason Leigh. And
who looks like Peter Sellers.
Yes, who looks like Peter Sellers. And things happen. Things happen. Stuff happens. And it all happens in and around their beautiful home, which is a Richard Neutra home.
That's an architect?
A famous L.A. architect.
Okay.
And apparently in real life, it was Sofia Coppola's house.
Oh, interesting.
And she let them shoot there. And it was shot famously at the time. This was a big deal. It was shot by the great cinematographer John Bailey digitally. And John Bailey is one of the most brilliant cinematographers alive and one of the most knowledgeable. You can read his blog online. He blogs through the ASC, the American Society of Cinematographers. He knows everything there is to know, and he knows history. He knows movie history and cinematography history and all that. And it was a big step for him to try digital filmmaking, as he did here, very successfully. So it convinced a lot of people that digital might be the way of the future, and it had a big impact in that sense, that quite apart from its entertainment value, which is considerable. It's really an interesting movie to watch. So much going on. And the two stars are really good. They wrote themselves really interesting roles.
It's riveting. And there's always something happening. It's a very surprising film, the way that it jumps from thing to thing to thing and how it all connects in the end. Very, very interesting. And I that's one of the beautiful things about it, is that it all takes place in this house.
Yeah.
So it's all about the characters.
And it's probably didn't make specific note of this, but I guess it's within 24 hours, even less than 24 hours.
Yeah, the events of a day, basically.
Yeah, and an all-night party into the wee hours, into the early morning the next day. And now if you haven't seen Jennifer Jason Leigh recently, because she doesn't work as much today as she did at one time, she's just a great actress. I remember first becoming aware of her in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which is now 30-some years old, but she was really good in it. And that's where she met Phoebe Cates. It gave a big boost to both of their careers, and apparently they became very close friends as a result of working together in that wonderful film. And she kept working in interesting movies, often daring and challenging movies. She's in The Big Picture, Last Exit to Brooklyn, Single White Female, the Coen brothers' The Hudsucker Proxy, where she approximates Katharine Hepburn's speaking voice.
Yeah.
And then, surprisingly, did it all over again in Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle, where she played Dorothy Parker. I mentioned Georgia, which was written by her mother, Barbara Turner, A Thousand Acres, Road to Perdition. And then she married Noah Baumbach and co-starred in Margot at the Wedding and got a story credit on his next film, Greenberg. And then they broke up. Sorry to say, they had a child and they broke up. But she is now appear. I don't know if they've finished shooting yet, but she's about to appear in Quentin Tarantino's new movie, The Hateful Eight.
Oh, okay.
And you know, Tarantino has a habit of reviving careers. Not necessarily people who've retired, but people who haven't been in the limelight exactly.
I'm sure it's just people that he loves that yes. He never thought of as – he's not thinking, I've got to revive this person. He's like, why is nobody working with this person? I'm
exactly.
going to work with this person.
Exactly, because he's such a voracious movie buff and he knows everything about everybody's career. So good for him for casting her, and I hope it's a good part. Alan Cumming needs little introduction from us. He's been doing wonderful work for many years. I think I first became aware of him about 20 years ago in a wonderful movie called Circle of Friends. Mm. He was in Eyes Wide Shut. He was in Julie Taymor's Titus. He probably reached his biggest audience as Nightcrawler in X-Men 2. He's been the host of Masterpiece Mystery on PBS for some years now. And for the past 5 years, he's been a regular on The Good Wife, a show my wife is addicted to.
I hear amazing things.
He also, a little more than 20 years ago, took on the role of the MC in the London production of Cabaret.
And that's where I first was aware of him.
And they later did a video version of that. He later brought it to Broadway and more recently revived it on Broadway and has made the part his own, seemingly. He also has done a lot of writing. He published an autobiography just last year called Not My Father's Son, which got very good reviews, which I haven't yet had a chance to read. So that's Alan Cumming, a very talented fellow. So he and Jennifer Jason Leigh sat down, wrote this vehicle for themselves and their friends, and they did a darn good job. It's such an interesting movie. So full of, you know, on the one hand, I think it's a little insidey because it is mostly about actors and people in show business, in Hollywood.
There's complexity in those relationships that are just so Los Angeles.
Yes, it's a very LA movie. And yet I think anybody would relate on some level to the interactions and to the conflicts and to the issues facing these characters, don't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially if you're trying to be a good person.
Yeah.
Because, you know, trying to be a good person is not easy. So you can rub people the wrong way. You know, you try to be decent to your neighbors, for instance, but there's that tension there. You might try to be decent to your husband's best friend that's a woman, mm-hmm. where there's some tension. You're like, is she trying to be my husband's wife, yeah. or she needs to get out of the way? So there's a lot of really interesting,
yes, exactly.
complex things in there, but the way that they handle them it's very Los Angeles at the same time.
Yeah. So it's universal and specific at the same time, which often is the case. There are a lot of people who believe, and I don't have a good quote ready, and I should, that the more specific you are, the more universal you become.
Right, right.
And
I know Lenny Bruce said that, you know, in comedy, so I take that mantle.
There's a scene where everybody does a toast for the anniversary couple.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently each actor devised his or her own toast. So that's part of it. I don't know if it was improv or scripted, but each one came up with their own material for that scene. Except for Gwyneth Paltrow, because her character had to convey very specific things. Mm. So they scripted hers. And it's really good. Now, there is a credit on the film for script consultant Barbara Turner, Jennifer Jason Leigh's mom. And then at the very end of the credits, a special thank you to her that says for less words or lesser words. So I think she probably helped them trim and prune the screenplay. Which is never a bad idea.
Yeah, definitely.
Never a bad idea.
I mean, a bunch of actors are just going to give themselves nonstop monologues. Come on. Someone needs to reel this in. Mom?
And we won't reveal anything else of the specifics except to say that just about at the halfway point of the movie, everyone takes ecstasy.
That's a big reveal, but what it brings out in people is very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this movie work.
You know what I enjoyed? I enjoyed all the source music on the track. Hmm. It's supposed to be – I think it's supposed to be being played in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
During the party.
The party's happening. They're playing music around.
But it's a little of everything. Mel Torme singing Coming Home, Baby, an old favorite of mine. Petula Clark singing I Know a Place. Marlena Dietrich singing I May Never Go Home Anymore. Francis Lay's theme from the French film A Man and a Woman. All sorts of stuff turns up on this soundtrack. And sometimes that can be distracting, but here I think it blends together very nicely. The Anniversary Party, 2001. And I was saying, just before we went on the air, I was saying to Barron, except for the fact that Jane Addams refers to a pager.
Yeah.
You could almost pass this off as a new movie, couldn't you?
They have a landline in the house as well, which some people have.
I do.
Some people have. But it's pretty – no one's haircut is obnoxious.
Yeah.
There's no haircut where you're like, well, that is so 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's pretty contemporary. Everybody looks like they're right now, basically, except people look younger. That's it. John C. Reilly, I was like, oh, right, look how young he is. Kevin Kline, certain people.
It's true. It's true. But we're having that experience every week, though,
That's true.
As we revisit films. That are 15, 20, 25, 30 years old. And as we felt when we saw young Robert De Niro a couple of weeks in a row for The King of Comedy and then for Midnight Run, it's like, oh, right, that is how he looked. You know, and the frightening part for me, less for you, I suspect, for me is then I must have changed too.
No, Leonard, you look exactly the same.
Yeah, I know.
You look like a day over 25.
If only. I wouldn't want to be 25. I wouldn't mind looking a little younger, but I'm comfortable in my skin. But it is amusing and interesting to observe that actors that we live with all the time, like De Niro, just to cite an obvious example, is, you know, as many people have observed, you know, aging certainly beats the alternative.
Right.
So we all age in different ways. We hope we grow old gracefully or grow older gracefully.
Right.
And most people do who are in the public eye or find a way to do that, some by artificial means, others naturally. But so it's a little jarring sometimes, and sometimes it's just a pleasant surprise to say, oh, I remember that's how they looked. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The best – and another thing about the anniversary party that – and it's the biggest reason that I went to watch it the first time is they wrote this for all of their friends. And it is a random assortment of people. It just goes to show you don't know who knows anyone.
Yeah.
Because the people in Hollywood that are just best friends with each other, they never work together.
Mm-hmm.
I could name three people right now. You're like, you know that person? Yeah, I do. No, I'm not going to do that. But that's what's interesting in that chemistry – that everybody has with each other, the familiarity of a group of friends. They really are a group of friends.
But they're not playing themselves.
They're not playing themselves.
Got to emphasize that. They're not playing themselves.
But they're playing their real connections to these people, at least.
Yes. Well, that's kind of a maybe a subtext in there. But they're all playing characters who are very specifically written and developed, and I think that's impressive. They didn't just say, oh, just act natural,
just
be yourself.
Just be you, yeah.
No, they didn't do that.
Devised characters for everyone.
Yeah, so it's a big recommendation there. So we have two – as usual, two good films that we're touting.
Anniversary Party is a really good movie for the Kevin Bacon game. Just saying.
Well, yes. So many links there. And Pollock. Two really good movies from the very beginning of the 21st century. And Dead Again, which we'll leave in the last century.
Again?
Again. And if, again, people want to get to know you a little better, how can they find you, Barron?
Oh, I'm on Twitter, BARVONBLAQ, BarronVaughn.com. And May 8th, Grace and Frankie, Netflix original series, start streaming. Watch out for that. What about yourself, Leonard?
Well, I don't have anything streaming right now except this podcast.
Yeah, it's true.
But I am on Twitter at Leonard Maltin. And I'm online as often as I can be at www.leonardmaltin.com. Hope to see you there, and we hope to see you here next time. Thanks for listening.
Pop. Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavor swirling together with cold brew topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. And that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.